Welcome to the Laverne Cox Show, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Think about the embodiment of hegemonic masculinity, how eroticism gets even constructed or manifested in our bodies, in men's bodies specifically. Because basically what he's trying to tell you is that even though his mind has advanced beyond what he thinks are appropriate performances of men and women to be doing, his penis has not.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Laverne Cox Show. On today's episode, we're talking about the challenges that college-educated women of color experience dating in the digital age. Now, many years ago, I was on this website called Plenty of Fish, and I got a message from a man. I went to his profile and was shocked. He said on his profile really disparaging things about why he would never date Black and Latina women, just things that were so horrible and so stereotypical. I just can't even bring myself to repeat them here today. And so I was just like, why would this man write me? So in the spirit of research, I wrote him back and I said, I read your profile. I'm obviously a Black woman. Why would you even, you know, write me and express interest in dating me? And what he said was, oh, I can date you because you're light-skinned. And then he said, and I've always been curious about trans women. And so I just kind of remember sitting there and just sort of being like, wow, this is really deep. And then I blocked him and I never had any communication with him again after that. But over the years, I've heard from so many Black women, both trans and non-trans, who have expressed frustration dating and attempting to date in the face of this kind of stereotyping, blamed racism, colorism, misogyny, and treating trans women as experiments and curiosities. When I came across Dr. Sarah Adeyinka-Scold's research on dating in the digital age with a focus on college-educated women of color, I knew I wanted to have this conversation with her. Dr. Sarah is a licensed clinical social worker and assistant professor of sociology at Furman University. She explores race, family, and gender in her research with a focused interest in how forming intimate romantic relationships reveal inequalities in these areas. Please enjoy my talk with Dr. Sarah. Hi, Dr. Sarah. How are you feeling today?
I'm good, Ms. Cox. How are you doing?
I'm well. You can call me Laverne.
All right. Just wanted to make sure.
Yes, my mother is Ms. Cox.
Okay. Good to know.
Can you talk to us just about the nature of your research and what really inspired this look into the challenges that college-educated women of color experience in dating? What was the beginning, the nexus of genesis, I should say, of you doing this research?
That's a great question. So for me, I've always been a little bit of a mushy, romantic. I love ear hustling about how people fall in love. I'm all about that. And when I was in high school, I was like, okay, so I'm going to go to college and I'm going to get married and it's going to be lit. Yay. And I went to college and that is not what happened. In fact, what I was noticing already was that my white college age friends were already partnering and my Black female friends were not. We weren't getting together. And I don't think that it was people weren't hooking up with us, but there was definitely this feel that we were going to have to wait to find our partners. Whereas a lot of the white folks that I knew were like in serious relationships at college. So my junior paper.
Where did you go to school? Where did you do your undergraduate work?
I went to Princeton University. And so I took a class with Mario Small, who I think is now at Harvard. And sort of everything became clear for me. My own understanding, I took a sociology class there. My own understanding of being a Black woman and things that hadn't made sense to me started to make sense. And so, you know, as someone who's interested in meeting and mating already, I was like, well, I got to figure out what's going on. Like, why aren't I dating? Why aren't my friends dating? Like, what's going on? So my junior paper looked at how Black women do marry, but they tend to marry down. I wrote a senior thesis that looked at how institutions like schools are actually matchmakers, and we don't often think of them as matchmakers. And schools can be mechanisms to facilitate homogamy, which is where people get married along the same class, educational, racial lines. But if you meet at work, for instance, you might be less likely to marry someone that is the same as you.
In terms of class.
In terms of class, education, race. But that might be changing now because work can be so specific. So I wrote a paper on that. I stopped there. And then my advisor was like, you got to go to graduate school because maybe this is an important thing to study. And I was like, oh, I don't want to go. And I had told myself that if I was still interested in this in 5 years, I would go to graduate school. So I read a book by Richard Banks called Is Marriage for White People? And the book pissed me off enough to be like, okay, I definitely need to go to graduate school.
Why did the book piss you off? What was the thrust of the book that pissed you off? The title is interesting.
His assumption was that Black women simply were not open to dating outside of their race. They were just closed off. And so I was like, that's not correct. I've been trying to date outside of my race. The wacky things that I've been seeing online, the ways in which people approach me was just incorrect. And I was like, this can't stand. I really need to go research this myself. And then, you know, as you're getting into your mid-20s, you're having these conversations with your non-Black friends and your Black friends, and you're starting to see, well, our experiences aren't that similar. They're similar in some ways, but they're not similar in other ways. And so that basically lit a fire under me. And I was like, I'm going to get my PhD and this is what I'm going to study. And for me, the comparisons are really key, right? I really want to talk to Black women, but I think the uniqueness of Black women's experiences, they really come into relief when you compare them to non-Black women's experiences. And that's what made me do the work that I'm doing.
Girl, there's so many things that you said there that I want to unpack on so many different levels. The first one, you just sort of alluded to marrying down. And if you just go online, if you go to YouTube, there's so many conversations about like hypergamy and Black women and like marrying up and what does that look like? And then like the interracial dating piece, there's so we Black women, I saw one study that suggested that Black women are less likely than Black men to date outside of the race, that we are more statistically more likely to pursue relationships with Black men than Black men are with us, right? So Where do we even begin with this?
We can start with the data about Black women being less likely to date and marry interracially. We do see that in census data, 2010. Mm-hmm. We see the data that Black men are actually twice as likely to marry interracially as Black women. But I don't think this is solely an issue of preference. I think in our world today, we really, you know, we have this rugged individualism. We tend to live in this pretend world where like the way that the US was set up to make Black people 3/5 of a human and then to put them at the bottom of the hierarchy doesn't at all impact our preferences. That doesn't make any sense. So we have to recognize that our preferences are within a particular kind of racial and gender order, and they're influenced by that order. For a long time, sexual abuses that Black women experience at the hands of white men didn't count as illegal.
Yeah.
You can't just ignore history and then pretend that Black women are just going to grow up in a vacuum where now it's just fine to date white or non-Black men. They have to be careful. We're seeing this even in our time now. Like, people are very bold about their hate and their dislike for Black women. You don't have to look far. Kamala Harris. So when Black women, in my opinion, and I see this in my data, so this isn't in my dissertation, it's in a forthcoming book called The Logic of Racial Practice. In my experience, Black women don't want to date Black men just because it feels good. It's about racial solidarity. How are you going to go through a life where you're constantly struggling and the person is like, maybe that's racial discrimination. Maybe it's not. You don't want that, mm-hmm. right? So as this, as white supremacy bears down more and more and more on Black women's lives, Black women are trying to advance. We are one of the most highly educated populations in the U.S., but our college degrees, our post-college graduate degrees are not getting us the same things that it is for non-Black women. So if we want to date Black men, it's because love is intimate. We want people that understand us and understand that struggle. And I haven't talked to Black men, so I don't know what their reasons are for dating white women. I can't speak to that. But for Black women, it's a little less than just like, well, I just want someone that's the same race as me. That race has history behind it. It has struggle behind it. It has resilience behind it. And in a world mm-hmm. like ours, where your Blackness is, people seek to trample upon it. They're saying, oh, we want to count all legal votes, but your vote is mm-hmm. illegal, right? Mm-hmm. You want to be with someone that is going to get that.
The immediate thing that I think about when I listen to you talk is trauma, mm. that the trauma, the history of the ways in which Black womanhood has been devalued in this country is deeply traumatizing. I think about my own mother mm. and how my mother, there's no way she would ever date a white man. She grew up in the segregated South. I remember we were in, it was 2012, so it was 8 years ago. We were in Vegas and she had just retired and we were both in Vegas for the first time. And she was supposed to meet me by the pool. We were staying at the Mirage and I went for a dip in the pool and I get out of the pool and I have like 10 messages from my mother. And I listened to the first one. She's freaking out. And she's like, you've got me out here around all these white people. She said to me, and I found her and we sat down and I said, are you afraid of white people? She's like, yes, I'm afraid of white people. And she was just so sort of riled up and it didn't clicked him. I was like, oh my God. And this is 8 years ago. So I'm like 40 mm. years old. And I was like, oh my God. She grew up in the segregated South, watched her father be called the N-word, was in segregated schools and then busted desegregated schools and experienced all that. There was so much trauma. She was passed over for a promotion mm-hmm. in the 80s for a white woman who didn't have the same education. And so I think it's our experience, but then I also know that trauma is passed down in our genes and in our DNA. And so I think about that level of trauma as I listen to what you just said. But then I think about, too, how so many Black men, particularly Black celebrities, rappers, et cetera, have no problem expressing their disdain mm-hmm. for Black women, mm-hmm. right? And their desire not to date Black women or that a Black woman must be light-skinned, so the colorism. And I think when we have this conversation, it has to be, we have to sort of talk about colorism and to talk about the ways in which certain skin tones are privileged in the dating market.
Yes.
What would you say to that?
So I would say that just based on the work that I've done, I think it's important to think about hegemonic masculinity. And when we think about the intersection of race and gender for Black men. So in our world, patriarchy, masculinity, hegemonic masculinity are very powerful ideologies. You know, when you read the New York Times and people are asking, well, why did Latino men vote for Trump? Why did Black men vote for Trump? A lot of the answer is, well, they really see him as a macho man. So what happens, I think, you know, based on my limited experience, is that for Black men, part of defining that masculinity is putting that above racial solidarity, right? By showing I am a man. And because of white supremacy, one way I can do that is by devaluing Black women. I'm seen as more valuable in the realm of white supremacy, in the world of white supremacy, if I'm able to join along with others to devalue Black women who are at the bottom of their racial hierarchy. So I think that whether or not Black men realize it, they're literally part of that process of maintaining and perpetuating white supremacy by devaluing Black women. And oftentimes they don't understand that. And so again, with white supremacy, skin tone always matters. So if my goal as a Black man is to get closer to whiteness, to get closer to white masculinity, of course I'm going to date a lighter skin Black woman, because all of it matters. Phenotype matters, skin color matters, what her nose looked like, all that matters in terms of maintaining my place as a man and a Black man within this racial hierarchy and within this context of white supremacy. So that's how I, as a sociologist, understand those actions.
This is such a complicated thing to talk about, I think, too, because the question that comes up for me is like, well, if we just have our preferences, mm-hmm. right? Like, I just am more attracted to someone who's lighter skinned, mm-hmm. and that's like not racism, it's just my preference. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people listening to this will say that. Mm-hmm. What would you say to the folks out there who are like, well, I just have a preference, and this, it's not necessarily racist or misogynist or colorist. Mm-hmm. I just like what I like. Mm-hmm.
I would say to them, you're not alone. That's a totally valid perspective to have. I'm all about interrogation. Why do you like what you like? Where does that come from? When did you start liking it? What does it mean for you to like it? And I'm not just talking objectively. I'm married to a white man. So I had to do that work for myself of like, well, what does it mean to be attracted to white men? What does it mean for a Black woman to hold up whiteness? What kind of life do I want to have with a white man? Why does it matter if I'm not or I am married to a white man? So I had to do that work for myself. And frankly, what I found for myself is if I'm going to be with a white man, he better bring me closer and closer and closer and closer to pro-Blackness. His treatment of me better upgrade my humanity all the time. So I think it's fine to have preferences, but just recognize that they don't exist in a vacuum. So interrogate, do the work, reflect on where those are coming from and why they are important to you.
And I think that the thing too is like, if we do have our preferences, then those preferences should not denigrate women with, I remember there was, I think, a famous singer or rapper or something who had a song about, you know, women with the good hair or something like that. And people were like, this is colorist, this is upsetting. And so that even if we have our preferences, that we're not in the process of denigrating people who don't fall into those preferences, right?
Exactly. And that's where the self-reflection comes from, because what you might actually find is if you're a non-white person, is that you actually might have some internalized racism that you haven't dealt with. You might find that you mm-hmm. have some internalized colorism that you haven't dealt with. So some of my respondents, they were in this situation where they were always attracted to white men. And then one woman said that she went on a fast where she started to decolonize her preferences. She's like, why am I attracted to this white guy, this mediocre white guy, when there are these Black men over here, these Asian men over here that are meeting the same criteria? She started to do that work of reflecting on those preferences. And so you might surprise mm-hmm. yourself. You might actually realize, wow, I'm holding on to these things because the media has influenced me, how people define beauty has influenced me. So that's why people don't want to do the work, because they might be afraid to let go of something. They might have to realize that actually, I don't think all people are the same. Mm-hmm. And so when you do that work, though, then you can really start to appreciate the humanity in other people. So you can still have your preferences, but not at the expense of denigrating other people.
Yeah, I think it always comes down to a loving, critical self-reflection mm-hmm. when it comes to all of these things. Yeah. That like, at the end of the day, it's like not about looking at other people and what their issues are, but like, how am I implicated in perpetuating or creating racism, misogyny, colorism, et cetera? Yeah. How am I participating in creating something new yeah. and starting new and different kinds of conversations? This is a good time to take a little break. We'll be right back, though, after a little love is thrown to our sponsors. Alrighty. Now that that's all taken care of, let's get back to our chat. my ex-boyfriend was white, and we, you know, posted on social media. And I remember with the first few times we posted, there were so many people who were frustrated and upset that I was dating a white man. And someone said, you know, why do all the LGBTQ celebrities, when they get famous, they find a white man? And there was just like a lot of people were very, very upset that my boyfriend was white. And it was just kind of, I was like, most of the men I've dated are white men. And, you know, and it's something I've thought a lot about, and it's something I've interrogated. But it's also about who is of any race, right, is going to treat me in the way that I feel I deserve to be treated and I should be treated. And so, you know, I happened to fall in love with a white man who treated me really well.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of it is about our options and being open. You know, I think there's a piece of trauma, though. I think for a lot of Black women, there's trauma around having been treated, especially dark-skinned Black women, having been treated so badly over and over again. As I was preparing for this, I read so many accounts from dark-skinned Black women who just have been made to feel like they are just less than nothing by men over and over and over again. And I think about how do we actually go into healthy relationships, right, where we can don't bring that baggage into it. Yeah. And what have you found in your research around the healing process that has to happen from all the wounds of the intersections of misogyny and colorism and racism for the folks that you've interviewed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things that I found in my work is that women, regardless of what race they are, they often experience negative interactions with men, both on and offline, when they're in their romantic partner search. And there are two ways in which women will often deal with these negative interactions. And one of them is emotion work, which is where they prioritize men's feelings. So if men are intimidated by their accomplishments, or men are intimidated by their educational level, they'll sort of downplay as part of this emotion work. They'll ask the man a lot of questions about what he's doing.
I've done that.
Yeah. One of my respondents talked about how they were going to be lawyers. She has a PhD in sociology. One of her friends was going to be a PR person in LA. And these men came up to them and they told them exactly what they were going to do. And the men, she said, they shrank. So she turned to her friends and she was like, we need to tell people that we're nannies or else we're never going to get laid. So that's priority. It's one of my favorite quotes. So that's prioritization of men's feelings around their accomplishments. But the other kind of coping mechanism that women did was emotion repair, which is where they prioritized their feelings, right? They weren't going to talk to any men that were showing any hints of intimidation. They weren't going to talk to any men who called them bitches online. They weren't going to talk to any men who use fetishization as a way to include them as romantic partners. It definitely shrank their pool, but you know what they felt? Empowered. So I would say to Black women especially, take care of yourself. This world that we're in is not about you. I know that sounds terrible to say, but take care of yourself. Surround yourself with people who know your worth and who know your value. And this is an ongoing process. As a social worker, I'm all about therapy. Even better if you do it with a Black person that maybe even understands where you're coming from. But like, trauma really needs you to air it out. It needs to be out in the open. You need to let someone carry that burden with you, because trauma will tell you that you're not enough. Trauma will tell you that you're less than. So you already have the value. You're already worth something. People can't take that away from you. So the work is in you finding it and stepping into it and daily. And again, this is not like a magical thing. Like, you're not going to wake up one day and be like, oh my God, I feel totally fulfilled enough and loved. It's going to be a constant thing because of the world that we live in and the American society that we live in. So Black women, you are already enough. There's no here or there about it. There's no discovering it. It's just walking up and waking into it and living it out. That's what that's about.
That's so beautiful. One of the main reasons I wanted to talk to you is that the ways in which so many men online have the way they treat us, the way they, the stereotypes they have, the ways in which they approach us. That is stuff that is systemic. That is something that is not, it's not our fault. And it's not something that we need to sort of blame ourselves for. And I think it's really, really important that we understand that a lot of these things are systemic.
Yep.
There's an element to this. There's so many elements to this. But the thing about being intimidating, many years ago, one of my first interactions with men, I was after I transitioned, or I don't even know if I had officially medically transitioned, but a man told me I was intimidating, right? And I just sort of assumed that for whatever reason, men find me intimidating. And this was like, you know, before I, you know, had any sort of success or whatnot. And so, and I tried to understand and parse out what that means, right? And some men liked being intimidated by me. They saw me as a challenge, and they were like, it was hot for them that I was intimidating for some reason. And other men have cowered and like sort of run away. And this has nothing to do with me even being trans. These are men who were attracted to me and knew I was trans. And so it's, but then I hear accounts from Black women, women of color who are not trans, or women who of all races who are very successful, and they hear that they're intimidating. And so I talk a lot with my girlfriends about how much work we've all done. And most of my girlfriends are really my super close girlfriends, the Council of Trans Sisters, we call I call ourselves the COTS. We do so much work on ourselves, trying to evolve and be better versions of ourselves, and to go out into the world with a sense of worthiness. And it's rare that we meet men who seem to be doing the same work. You know, they say that they're woke and they're feminist and they're whatever, but then their practices don't really bear it out. I think I've told this story on this podcast before, but I had a man many years ago tell me that he, you know, he was a feminist and he loved women and wanted to empower women. But then when it came down to his penis working and him becoming sexually aroused, the woman had to make less money than him. She had to even be less attractive. As woke as he wanted to be, and an amazing, he really was an amazing, awesome guy, but like he literally could not physically get there for a woman who was more successful. And so this is what we're up against, you know? So I think that like, I'm not in the business of demonizing anyone.
Yeah.
So what is the prescription? What are we to do?
I mean,
you know, if this is the world we live in.
It's really fascinating because I haven't done this work, but I think it'd be really interesting to think about the embodiment of hegemonic masculinity and the eroticism, how eroticism gets even constructed or manifested in our bodies, in men's bodies specifically. Because basically what he's trying to tell you is that even though his mind has advanced beyond what he thinks are appropriate performances of men and women to be doing, his penis has not. So there's something about, in sociology, there are famous people who've written about this, about the performance of gender, about the performance of femininity and masculinity. And when you perform it so long, so what you're really talking about is like this deep embodiment of masculine performance and a belief and a deep embodiment in what feminine performance is, and then literally being unable to get aroused because your penis does not believe in, cannot get past the fact that this woman is performing femininity in a way that doesn't fit these ideals of gender norms. I'm literally stuck in hegemonic masculinity. I'm literally stuck in a place where I can't get up because a woman is not performing femininity in the traditional ways. So I think that says something about how deep patriarchy, misogyny, hegemonic masculinity, we see them as structures, but it's literally playing out on his body. And I think that that's powerful and real for a lot of people, but maybe they haven't had even the language to be able to talk about it in the way that he has.
Wow, that is so incredibly deep, but I feel like that leaves us in a very precarious position mm-hmm. for a lot of women who date men. Something that came up with what you just said is that historically, right, the ways in which patriarchy has sort of and racism has intersected mm-hmm. in the lives and bodies of Black women mm-hmm. is that like womanhood was something historically that was really preserved for white mm-hmm. women. When Sojourner Truth declared "Ain't I a Woman" exactly. in 1851 in Ohio, exactly. she said this in the context of her Blackness being disavowed mm-hmm. because she wasn't a man mm-hmm. and her womanhood being disavowed because she was not a white woman. Mm-hmm. And so that history sort of persists. You know, Black women have often had their femininity sort of stripped from them by misogyny and white supremacy. And these assumptions that Black women are less womanly mm-hmm. and less feminine. Mm-hmm.
Well, I really think it's back to what you said about structure. And in sociology, we're always battling between how much does the structure constrain our agency and how much agency do we have? You are an example of doing that work and continuing to do that work. I'm just talking about heterosexual women. I cannot imagine the barriers that trans women are going through as they're searching for partners. It is immense, right? Intersectionality is going to tell us that they're going to have a lot more troubles than we are, both structural and agentic, right? But the thing is, like, you can't give up. You have the cots. They are helpful to you. They help you to yeah. live. They help you to survive. So the world isn't going to change that fast. But as much as we can, we're responsible for how we react to that and how we walk in it. This connection between sociology and social work is really important because sociology says this is the structure and this is how the structure constrains your agency. And then social work says, but let's work together to empower that agency. And part of that is recognizing that there's a structure that you can't deal with, but there are all these other parts of your life that you can deal with. So I honestly would say that to the man that said his penis can't do it. Well, maybe there needs to be some work done there, right? You can't solve that problem. No woman can solve that problem. And that's not her problem to solve.
No.
That's his work to do. So let's leave men to do their work. So we, all of us, white women, Black women, we need to call it out every time the structure lets men off the hook and puts more burden on us. The reason we are where we are is because Black women, Sojourner Truth, men like women like her, they called it out every single time and they did what they could to make sure that it didn't go on. So that's part of the work too. It's not just this personal journey, you know, to whom much is given. You're just held more accountable. So as an upwardly mobile Black woman, it's my job to call out patriarchy. It's my job to call out racism and then to act in ways that resist that. So that's what I see that we can do. We can't just let the structure overtake our agency. If we have the means to advocate for people, we need to do that too.
Mm-hmm. I feel like there's a crisis that men, I would say heterosexual men, specifically mm-hmm. cisgender heterosexual men, let's qualify that, are having a crisis that they're having around women's roles shifting in society. And I guess there's this promise, right, for men of all races. If I am a man, then I should be their breadwinner mm-hmm. and I should make more money and I should do this and this and this and this. And then the culture, right, the structure mm-hmm. actually of society isn't set up for all men mm-hmm. to be able to do that. And so it's like we've been lied to, we've been betrayed, mm-hmm. and there's this frustration. And a lot of times that frustration is taken out on women, LGBTQ people, immigrants, mm-hmm. people of color. There is this set of assumptions and stories mm-hmm. that men have been told about themselves, and they're lies.
Yep.
They're lies. I see all this pain and trauma around these sort of expectations mm-hmm. around patriarchy.
Yeah.
Does your research tell us anything about how men can begin to heal around this? I guess what the work is.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great question. And my research is primarily with women, but I think that mm-hmm. this is like some introduction to sociology stuff. Gender is a social construction. I think a lot of people think that what they've been told and what they've learned is natural, and that mm-hmm. becomes what they believe. So because I'm a man, I'm entitled to A, B, C, and D, and that's the natural order of things. And so if you don't understand that gender is constructed in a particular way where men are at the top and women are at the bottom, and then whoever is deviating from that is even further at the bottom, then it's much easier for you to believe those narratives and to believe those lies, because we've been taught that, but we also in many ways perpetuate this so-called natural order of male superiority to women. And so it's, the work has to start pretty simply, which is, it's actually not true. What they told you was a lie. They made it up so that they could create a particular kind of society that operates a particular kind of way and benefits a particular kind of person. Uh-huh. So if we understand that masculinity and femininity are a construction and they're made real by our performance of them, then that can help us go a long way. So if you read this article, it's called Doing Gender. They have this story where they share where Agnes is a trans woman and she's dating this cis hetero man. And he basically tells her, you can't do this because men will think that you're overbearing. You should sit this way. You should dress that way. So what that man is actually alluding to is trans women are learning the performance of femininity. And he appreciates that because part of that performance means that they're performing as though men are superior. They're performing as mm-hmm. though women are inferior. So to heal is to come to the reality that what you're performing, how you're defining yourself, is all constructed in a particular way to serve a particular kind of purpose. Now, I don't know how you move forward from there, but you know, I think it's kind of like AA. You just got to admit, this is who I am. This is what it is. So we got to admit mm-hmm. first, gender is a construction. So how am I playing into that narrative? And maybe that's where men, cis hetero men, can find the liberation that they need. And there are plenty of cis hetero men that understand this. So it's not like they have to walk alone. So the education is there if people want to seek it out. If you just want to lie and feel sorry for yourself, if you want to, you know, grovel in the emasculation and that kind of thing, you can, but that's not using your agency. And literally, humanity is all about being able to use our agency. So if you want to grab onto your humanity, then you can learn more about what it is you're feeling and why you feel that way.
Well, I think it's not always wallowing in emasculation. Yeah. A lot of times it's about blaming other people. It's about lashing yes. out, right? It often functions in lashing mm-hmm. out at people for various things. And the one thing I'll say about my own men who've said they, you know, appreciate trans women mm-hmm. sort of embracing a certain kind of femininity, that like the reality of my experience in dating is that even though a man might be attracted to me because he presumes mm-hmm. I embrace a certain kind of femininity, once he gets to know me and understands I'm a feminist and understands that I'm not really interested in any of anything traditional, I don't want to get married. There are a lot of things I don't want to do. And so it's tricky, right? Mm-hmm. Alrighty, it's that time again. A lot more is coming though. We'll be right back. Alrighty then. Let's just dive right back in. So much of my experience as a trans woman has been like sort of being fetishized and being sort of treated as this sort of fascination mm. or experiment. And the experiences of so many women of color are also very similar, yep. right? We're fetishized in a really interesting and specific way. Yep. You know, there's so many people over the years who've I've heard people say that, you know, I'm not racist. I, you know, my boyfriend's black, or I'm not racist. My girlfriend's black. And I'd like to remind those people that slave owners had sex with the slaves, yep. but that does not mean that they were not engaged in a system mm-hmm. that subjugated black folks. So what I actually think about racial fetish in relationship to trans fetish, because I think this could be experiences of a lot of women of color online and trans women and around being fetishized. What has your research told you about that?
That's what I definitely found. One of the things I really wanted to explore was, well, what does the exclusion of Black women look like online? And what does the inclusion of Black and non-Black women look like online? And so when it comes to, you know, interracial dating, a lot of times this inclusion is about fetishization. When you see someone's full humanity, then their power is equal to yours. Fetishization is all about wielding your superiority over some other person that you deem inferior, but you're upgrading them because you think they fit a special category if you're not seeing people as fully human. So it's all about, I think about it as like colonization, right? Because we don't really see this fetishization the same way if women are doing it. But with men, it's all about, oh, I'm putting how I view you onto you. You're not defining your humanity. I'm defining your humanity. So fetishization is all about power. And it's all about cis men being able to put their view of what minority women are like and obscuring their humanity at best, and at worst, defining it on behalf of women. And that's where the assumptions come from, even when we talk about trans fetishization. So it's like, well, because I think you care about your femininity, this is what I think femininity is, these traditional ways of being feminine. So once you don't fit that, oh no. But then that's again, me putting my assumption of what I think femininity is onto you. And that's a power play. And nobody wants that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just thought about this thing that I say to my girlfriend. She was telling us a story about this guy. They had met online and she had gone to meet him downtown. And he was like, I can't believe I'm going to say this, but he wanted to go into his car and have sex with her in his car. And she was like, no, you're going to take me out. You're going to do this. And I said, girl, you wanting him to take you out and treat you like a human being, that's your fantasy. Him wanting to get you in the car, that's his fantasy. And ultimately, it's about his fantasy, not yours.
Exactly.
So he never took her out, right? She didn't get in the car. But like so often, what I found, it's about their fantasy and not mine. Mm-hmm. And so one has to be willing to walk away from their fantasy because it's not going to serve us. It just, unless you wanted to get in the car, you know?
Right, if you want
and
that.
And I'm not shaming anybody for that.
Yeah. And that's the structure. The structure is set up so that his fantasy is prioritized over your fantasy. And you don't have to be about that. You can use your agency to resist the structure and look for someone who wants to have the same fantasy as you.
Yeah, the fantasy that can become a reality.
Exactly.
So you've talked about dating closet racist. Can you explain what that looked like for you?
Oh, yes, I can. oh my God, this story is so embarrassing. So basically, I dated this guy who, you know, said he was interested in Black women and he was cute. And I was like, I thought he was cute. I thought he was interesting. And with me, you know, within two or three dates, we start to talk about race. This is something I find important. It's important to my own survival. So he's like, well, I think that the idea was that he felt like I was too much like Malcolm X and not enough like MLK. These were the words that he used. So he felt that racial progress, we just have to wait. So he called me militant. I was a militant Black person and that I need to appreciate slow progress. And that's when I knew I was in trouble because I was like, no one that is about my humanity and is about my Blackness is going to tell me that I need to wait on progress. And all of the people, both Nigerian and African American, that have come before me and set me up for where I am, they did not wait for progress. So that's when I was like, oh, you might like Black women, but you don't like Black humanity. So you're a closet racist.
Mm. Wow, that's really deep. How did it end? Did you say that to him? Did you just like not call him back? Because is there a moment where you thought, let me see if there can be a transformational moment, a teachable moment here? How did that play itself out?
So I'm ashamed to admit that this casual relationship went on for a little too long. It was like 2 or 3 months. And there had been signs that he might be a closet racist, that he might be someone who's like a social conservative, like people need to make their own money. But I'm like, you're living in an apartment that your parents are paying for. Like, what are you actually talking about? And so these things sort of emerged. And so that was the last conversation we had. I dropped him off at his house. Girl, he didn't even have a car. I dropped him.
But people need to make their own money.
Didn't have a car, but yet you want to talk about how people need to pull themselves up by the bootstraps. Okay, whatever. So all that emerged. I dropped him off at his house and I was just like, we're not going to need to get along. We don't agree on things that are very important to me. And then he called me and left me a long message that I just deleted and I never spoke to him again.
Do you remember what the message said?
I'm really sorry for the things I said. I didn't mean it. I really hope that we can talk again. And I'm not sure that I understood those kinds of things.
Bless his heart. He was probably doing the very best he could.
Yes.
And as Brené Brown tells us, if we assume people are doing the best they can, then we must set boundaries.
Exactly. So my boundary was, I'm never going to see you again. And I need to really be more careful about white men that I date if I'm dating a white man. The signs are probably always there. I just kind of was like, oh, he's cute, blah, 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 blah. But I was just like, oh, no. I need to be way more careful.
I think that's if you're dating anyone that we have to look for, because the information is usually there. People are usually telling us who they are through various actions. And it's our job. I think that's just part of the process, that our job over time is to learn what they're telling us and to discern that it's faster.
Yeah.
And I think the beautiful thing about what you've shared here is that I bet the next time you met a white man or any man, you were more astute, you were more adept at like looking for those things. And so I think that's how we learn, is that we have these experiences.
Yeah. And that's part of the invisible labor that Black women are doing oftentimes, right? This is the work that you don't even know that you're doing it half the time. And everyone is doing this work in general, and when they're dating and trying to make sure that they're not hooking up with people who are toxic for them. But then Black women have this added layer of like, am I dating somebody who's about my humanity or not?
So I like to end every podcast with this question, what else is true? And it comes from the community resiliency model and the idea of shift and stay and being in this space of both and, right? The world might be very challenging right now and it might be hard for me, but there is something else that is true. There's something that is positive or neutral in my body and in my life that I can also focus on. And so I'd like to ask you, Dr. Sarah, what else is true for you today?
Well, what else is true for me and for all the Black women out there and for you, Laverne, is that Black women are enough. That's what else is true. In a world where Black women are devalued and degraded, Black women may not feel as though they're enough, but their humanity already exists. They just need to wake up and walk in it.
Amen. Amen. I am enough. You are enough. Praise be. Thank you so much, Dr. Sarah. Where can people find you online?
You can find any of my work, any of my articles on Twitter at Lovey Scold. And so everything that I've published is available via link that way. And folks are also free to email me as long as they're not stalking me or sending me bad messages. Sarah.Arienka Scold. Arienka-Scold@Furman.edu. So people can reach me there. But Twitter is probably the best way to reach me. If you're looking for me, it's Dr. Sarah A.S. You can also find me that way. So, yeah.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your work, your research, and thank you so much for spending time with me today.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And it was a really a lovely conversation.
I wasn't prepared for how difficult this one would be for me. I think it's because it's the piece of weaving in my own kind of personal narrative and how painful a lot of it's been for me. So I'm so very grateful to Sarah having the sort of courage to be vulnerable and to talk me through it and to give me great data, research, and perspective to try to get to something hopefully that is substantive for me and for all of you. Thank you for listening to The Laverne Cox Show. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, subscribe, and share with everyone you know. Join me next week when I talk to Dr. Karen Franklin, a forensic psychologist and award-winning researcher, about why some people target transgender and other sexual and gender minorities in assaults and hate crimes. Knowing why is the first step to change. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laverne Cox and on Facebook at Laverne Cox for Real. The Laverne Cox Show is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.